Hello, I'm Kathy Coulomb. This is number 0101, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0101. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, criminal defense lawyer Darren Kavanoky talks about some of the big U.S. trials like Casey Anthony.
It reminds me of watching sports teams play in the big championship games where the commentators will all predict that one side will enjoy a lopsided victory over another, but there's a saying in sports about you have to play the game on the field, not just in the television commentary booth. And it's the same thing when it comes to high-profile trials. You've got to let it play out in the courtroom. And here, obviously, the way it played out, Casey Anthony was acquitted.
Jerry Piscatelli is one of the creators of Porto Pong, the beer pong game you can take anywhere. How did this idea come about?
Me, my friend and partner, Sal, were getting ready for an annual Florida vacation trip and decided that we wanted to bring something cool and exciting down with us on our trip. Got together, had a few beers, came up with the idea, found out no one was selling it, and Porto Pong was invented.
We remember the late Sherwood Schwartz, creator of Gilligan's Island. Here's what Bob Denver, Gilligan himself, said about Sherwood many years ago when I interviewed him about his former boss.
It's amazing. That man was just amazing. We never knew there was any problems when we were shooting. He kept all the network, kept craziness away from us. He was writing scripts literally, 4 months in advance. So, special effects and props always got them in plenty of time. You just memorized your words and just went down there and had a great time.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0101, is Kathy Coulomb, who is a writer and researcher at Radio Canada International. She works on a show called The Link. And you can check out the link that I put in to Radio Canada International and the show, The Link, by going to the website, thestufffile.com. And thank you very much, Kathy, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Gregory Snelling, age 41, was indicted in June for the robbery of a Key Bank branch in Springfield, Ohio, which was notable more for the foot chase with police afterward. Oh, they caught him, but Snelling might deserve style points for the run, covered as he was in red dye from the money bag, and the fact that he was holding a beer in his hand during the entire chase. Guy knows his priorities, I guess. Meanwhile, in Vienna, Austria, Nico Alm thought it'd be fun to test the new Austrian law saying that head coverings would only be allowed on official document pictures for religious reasons. So Nico, who's an atheist, applied for a new driver's license with a photo of himself wearing a pasta strainer on his head, claiming that he was a pastafarian and that the headpiece was required by his religion. The application process took 3 years, but it finally went through and Nico got his new license. Of course, police officials in the mostly Catholic country were not amused. They said religion was not an issue in Nico's case and that he only succeeded because he fulfilled the only criterion required, and that is leaving his face fully visible in the photo. Wow, an atheist with a sense of humor. God love him. Oh, that was an ironic statement, wasn't it? Anyway, the thing about atheists are when it comes to their own funeral, they are the personification of all dressed up and nowhere to go. In Radnor, Pennsylvania, two completely intoxicated young men got the bright idea of breaking into a police van to take photos of themselves, pretending to get arrested. That fantasy photo op turned into reality when the idiots locked themselves inside and smoked cigarettes and spat saliva to pass the time. When another inebriated friend arrived to rescue them, he too was confounded by the vehicle's lock system and called 911 for help. ensuring that the men would not only get out of the locked vehicle, but also get locked right back up. Radnor Constable Mike Connor, whose van the men allegedly burglarized, summed it up pretty well by saying, "It was unfreaking believable." Yep. Pretty stupid, too. Almost the idiot of the day. Almost. But they're inebriated, so it could also have been winners of the Charlie Sheen Award, which we give out for doing things under the influence, but still not quite up there. By the way, the idiot of the day comes up a little later on. Over in China, they've got a pretty popular dating show on TV called Happy League. A current forerunner on the show was Mr. Liu Xiao, who seems to be the ideal candidate as a romantic partner. The 39-year-old music teacher wooed the audience with his soulful singing and won over fans as he beat out a competing bachelor with his high-energy techno dance moves. The current bachelorette on the show was so intrigued that she picked Liu out of 8 eligible bachelors. Too bad she picked a possible killer. Police just arrested Liu after they received an anonymous tip from a viewer who recognized him as a suspect in a murder case from the 1990s. Turns out Liu is believed to actually be Wu Gang, who allegedly stabbed a man to death more than 13 years ago outside a restaurant. Back in the 90s, he was detained as a key suspect in the case but managed to escape. He's been free from the law for so long, he apparently became overconfident about not being caught and was dumb enough to go on TV. Again, somebody else who could have been the idiot of the day, but I digress. That comes up later. So, Liu is looking for dates. Well, good. Enjoy prison. And patients at a hospital in Cardiff, Wales say they were too scared to use a day room for patients as it was so far from staff that no one would hear them if they were calling for help. There was no call button in the room either. Staff at the Royal Infirmary's West Wing provided a solution. They placed a tambourine in the room for patients to summon a nurse in emergencies. If that didn't work, there's a pair of maracas. The patient's plight came to light when a man visited his 90-year-old mother at the hospital. "I thought she was joking about the tambourine," he said, "but then I went to the day room and there it was." The identified man said he shook the thing, but after 16 minutes, I gave up as no one responded. The National Health Service is investigating. So he shook the tambourine and no one showed up. Yeah, but did he try the maracas? Try the maracas, man. You gotta try the maracas. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Darren Cavanocchi is a Los Angeles criminal defense attorney, and we go to him often to talk about some of the big legal cases that make the news. He joins us now on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Darren.
Hey, Peter. Glad to be joining you.
Nice to have you back on with us. Now, one of the things I want to talk about, actually two, the Casey Anthony trial and also the Dominic Strauss-Kahn case. And the reason why I want to talk about these two is because, to me, these are two examples of the fact that the U.S. criminal justice system actually works. If it was a situation where you had two people that you wanted to put in jail because of them being just bad, not nice people, in other words, character assassination, then they'd both get life. But when it comes
or perhaps the death penalty, yes.
Exactly. But when it comes to dealing with the facts, in both cases, we have a situation where there just isn't enough information to convict. First of all, as a criminal defense attorney, your thoughts on the verdict in the Casey Anthony trial, because I know a lot of people are very upset at the verdict.
Yeah, and it reminds me of watching sports teams play in the big championship games where the commentators will all predict that one side will enjoy a lopsided victory over another, but there's a saying in sports about you have to play the game on the field, not just in the television commentary booth. And it's the same thing when it comes to high-profile trials. You've got to let it play out in the courtroom. And here, obviously, the way it played out, Casey Anthony was acquitted. And I think it really is, as you point out, a wonderful example of the system working. Notwithstanding whatever people felt about her, notwithstanding that she certainly could have been convicted in the court of public opinion of various high crimes and misdemeanors, the jury unanimously concurred that there was insufficient evidence in order for the prosecution to meet its burden of proof. And frankly, in all too many cases, it seems that jurors can get swayed by the emotion or by some kind of personal animus or by a variety of things that have nothing to do with the actual case being litigated in the courtroom. But in this particular case, jurors, to their credit, were able to put aside whatever the emotional pull was and just decide based on the facts or the absence of fact that there just wasn't enough there.
Now, was there a problem that prosecutors perhaps maybe bit off a little more than they can chew with some of the charges against her and going after the death penalty? Could that have made a difference if they didn't go that route?
Well, in American capital cases, the trials are bifurcated in a case where the prosecution is seeking the death penalty. So there's actually two separate trials, the first pertaining to guilt or innocence, and the second being the punishment phase, where the jurors deliberate and determine whether the person is to receive death or a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. So the idea that this was a death penalty case may have been playing in the background of the minds of the jurors, but I don't think that was the issue that turned it. I think at the end of the day, it was really the absence of information. There were just too many question marks left in the minds of the jurors. I heard somebody describe it as the prosecution was able to put down all of the dots that it wanted to. It just didn't connect the dots effectively. And ultimately, I think that's to their undoing. It reminds me of another case that happened not too long ago in San Diego, where it was a Marine wife, Cynthia Summers, who was accused of poisoning her husband, and there was no real direct evidence to link her to the crime, but she certainly engaged in conduct unbecoming to a grieving widow. In the weeks and months following the death, she was winning wet t-shirt contests and things of that nature. And she was convicted initially, and then the case was reversed on appeal, and ultimately the case was undone. The prosecution, it turns out, didn't have enough evidence, and some of the forensic evidence was of dubious value. And I think here it was the same thing, where bystanders and people were just outraged, and the death threats have been pouring in towards her and towards the defense team. But ultimately, what the evidence showed in the Casey Anthony case was it left people perplexed and left people scratching their head. How could a mother not report her child missing for 31 days? And that was a big emotional hurdle, I think, for the defense to get over. And frankly, as a parent, I sit here and I scratch my head, and I, you know, if my kid was gone for 31 seconds, let alone 31 days, I'd be on the phone to 911. Mm. And at the same time, that wasn't sufficient to connect the dots. I can't, just like the jurors can't, sit here and speculate and say, well, okay, this is highly abnormal, but therefore she must have killed the kid. There just needed to be more, and the prosecution didn't have it.
On the other side of the table, the defense, they seem to have what I like to say is a kitchen sink defense. I was surprised at how many things they tossed up, how many plates they had spinning in the air as to possibly what happened, from sexual abuse from her father to all kinds of speculation to an accidental drowning. Was that to confuse the jury, and did it work?
Well, you know, it certainly was something that I thought, in watching the trial unfold, could have been the undoing of the defense team, because they wrote checks in opening statements that I don't think they cashed when they were dealing with their case and putting on evidence. And it's really a dangerous move when you make promises such as, the evidence will show that Casey was the subject of a variety of abuses suffered at the hands of her father or her brother, and then you don't deliver on that with good concrete evidence, but instead it was simply denials. But you know, the wild card in jury trials is often the jurors, And, of course, you know, Peter, being an astute courtroom observer as you are, the trials are really, there's a huge element of theater going on there. The objective truth of a situation often becomes irrelevant. It's a model of truth. It's a model of what it represents the truth that gets constructed in a courtroom. And once you construct that model, it makes objective truth irrelevant. So maybe jurors were confused, or maybe it gave some jurors something to hang their hats on. Candidly, given the short amount of time that the jurors actually deliberated on this case, it seems to me that it was the questions that remained unanswered that really is what did them in. Them being the prosecution.
You mentioned the theater of it all, and I find it interesting. I keep hearing people who talk about the idea of courtrooms being on television, that, you know, the founding fathers had always said that the courtroom should be open to everyone, and they wanted to build courtrooms large enough that the entire town or community could take part and watch a trial take place. But the founding fathers never envisioned television.
No, but no, and they never envisioned the 24-hour media machine that is like a great white shark and needs to be constantly fed. It's amazing how the media, and I mean this as no disrespect towards you, and certainly I take part in this myself, but there's this news cycle that requires that it be fed constantly and sometimes has the effect of making big things out of little things. And no, I doubt the forefathers anticipated any of this, but that's why we regard our Constitution and the Bill of Rights as a living, breathing document that is interpreted and reinterpreted over time to carry out the fundamental principles, but the application of those principles is going to evolve as society evolves.
Okay.
So, and I really say, open the courtroom doors. It's a great way to preserve integrity, to make sure that everybody gets to see what's going on there. Frankly, I think all the trials should be televised. And you know what? If we're going to actually be serious about the argument that the death penalty is really there to have a deterrent effect on anybody, they should televise the executions too.
Ooh, that's a topic for another day. I've got just a few minutes to go here, but I want to talk a little bit about the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case that took place in New York City. The former head of the International Monetary Fund, who was accused of raping a maid in the hotel, the swanky hotel that he was staying at. And again, this is a situation where you have a character, this being DSK as he is known, who is not a very likable person, and therefore people would like to see him drawn and quartered. But again, it's a situation where there just isn't enough evidence in this case to pursue it to the way that the U.S. or the New York authorities would like to. On the other side of the coin, some people are screaming, certainly the French are screaming, that he's been railroaded, they didn't let him out of the country. Based on the allegations that were first stated and the fact that he was on his way to the airport when they picked him up, they had no other reason, no other option but to arrest him, didn't they?
Right. Well, and certainly flight risk obviously was a concern, and that's why the house arrest and the forfeiture of the passport and obviously when they pull him off the plane, then they've got concern that this is a guy who's not necessarily incentivized to stick around. But here again, I think that your observations at the top of the show were exactly correct here, that it really is an example of the system working. Prosecutors in criminal cases have a unique duty. Their duty is to do justice. And what that means from a practical standpoint is they are not supposed to file a case, or they are supposed to immediately dismiss a case if they don't believe that they can prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt. To the exclusion of every reasonable doubt, or as I like to say, until the case is 100% free of reasonable doubt. And if the case implodes, if the witnesses prove to be unreliable, if there's new evidence that comes to light that is exculpatory, if it comes to their attention that they can't meet their burden. And notice, I'm not saying that they're dealing with an innocent man wrongfully accused. I'm saying that they don't meet their burden, then they're doing the right thing by cutting him loose. It's a fundamental notion, and it's an oft-cited principle in American jurisprudence, that it's better for 100 guilty men to go, and not just men, women, better for 100 guilty people to go free than for one innocent person to be convicted. And so if there's a reasonable doubt that the prosecutor has about whether or not they can meet their burden, they are duty-bound, ethically obligated to do what's required, which is to cut the person loose.
Darren, it's always a pleasure to share your legal mind with our audience. A pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
The pleasure's mine, Peter. Until next time, my friend.
Los Angeles criminal defense attorney Darren Cavanocchi. You can check out his website at nocuffs.com. And, of course, you can find links to his website by going to thestufffile.com. Just check out the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0101.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet one of the creators of Porto Pong, the beer pong game that you can take with you anywhere. And we'll also remember the late Sherwood Schwartz, who created, among other things, Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. Plus, we have an idiot of the day and lots more stuff, including stuff right here, right now. A woman in southern New Jersey reported an unusual visitor at her back porch, a baboon. And she wasn't the only one near Six Flags Great Adventure to meet such an evolutionary cousin. There was a sighting on a golf course and another near a highway, so the beast is suspected to be one of the 150 kept at the park's monkey jungle. No evidence of an escape has been found, and a spokeswoman for the park said the baboons, which sleep outside, are not counted every day. We can't say for sure where the baboon came from, she said. Really? Somebody else has baboons in New Jersey? But we are probably certain that it is ours. After the 2-year-old baboon was caught, we're essentially claiming her, said the spokesperson. Even though, being only 2, the captive did not have the identity chip the park normally implants in its baboons. I can't say for sure, but it's probably certain the baboon knows where it's from. But I digress. On to Kansas. Guinness World Records said a Kansas man who underwent a tonsillectomy and also had his adenoids removed set a record for the world's largest tonsils. the record-keeping organization, and by the way, they keep records on just about everything, don't they? It's kind of creepy. Said one of the tonsils removed from Justin Werner, age 21, of Topeka at the Excellent Surgery Center in Topeka on January 18th, measured 2.1 inches long, 1.1 inches wide, and 0.7 inches thick, while the other measured 1.9 inches long, 1 inch wide, and 0.7 inches thick. This according to the Topeka Capital Journal. And by the way, going to a hospital called Excellent Surgery Center, boy, if they ever make a mistake, do they have to change their name? Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. The tonsils were respectively 0.8 inches and 0.6 inches longer than the previous record tonsils, which were removed from Justin Dodge in Milwaukee. I find it more humorous than anything, Werner said of his record, which was made official on June 22nd. Werner said talking, breathing, and sleeping has become much easier since having the tonsils removed. The day after I got them out, there was no snoring at all, Werner said. Haven't had a sore throat since. Well, good for you. I know what you're thinking. There probably isn't a reason to measure everything on this guy. Let's just stop with the tonsils, shall we? This might make you weary of buying that next couch from a local thrift store. In Salisbury, North Carolina, police arrested 55-year-old Randall Boyd Johnson after he allegedly sat on a couch at the Salvation Army thrift store. Okay, there was a little more to it than that. He sat on the couch with his pants down around his ankles and leg propped up, completely exposing everything nobody wanted to see. He was arrested and charged with indecent exposure. He's also been banned from the Salvation Army. No word on whether or not that couch is still for sale. But, no thanks. This is a robbery, said the note a man passed to the clerk at a convenience store in Dover, Delaware. The robber demanded cigarettes, and the clerk handed over 17 packs, but refused to give back the demand note. The robber fled, and police arrived within seconds and stopped the suspect's vehicle. Bruce Manlove, yes, that's his name, Manlove, age 36, was arrested when officers found 17 packs of cigarettes in his car. If that evidence isn't convincing enough for you, the note the clerk kept was written on the back of a prison release paperwork form, the one for Bruce Manlove, age 36. Well, he won't be needing the prison release paperwork anyway, not anymore. And again, somebody named Bruce Manlove, and he's going back to jail? Ooh, awkward. And a 200-exhibit installation on the history of dirt and filth and their importance in our lives opened in London in a gallery featuring The Ordinary, that would be dust, The Educational, a video tribute to New York's Fresh Kills Landfill, at the time one of the world's largest, The Medical, vials of historic, nasty-looking secretions from cholera victims, and The Artistic, bricks fashioned from feces gathered by India's Dalits who hand-clean latrines. Dirt may worry us as a society, said the exhibit's curator, but we have learned that we need bits of it, and, guiltily, secretly, we are sometimes drawn to it. Capping the exhibit, leaning against the wall, was what appeared to be in a distance an ordinary broom, but whose handle was studded with diamonds and pearls. All I have to say is ick. That's it. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I'm sure there are many out there who have played beer pong, especially if you went to college. Well, Jerry Piscatelli is one of the creators of Porto Pong, the world's first inflatable beer pong table. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm just doing tickety-boo. I would assume, as the old saying goes, when it came up with this idea, alcohol was involved?
Just a little bit. Me, my friend and partner, Sal, were getting ready for a annual Florida vacation trip and decided that we wanted to bring something cool and exciting down with us on our trip. Got together, had a few beers, came up with the idea, found out no one was selling it, and Porto Pong was invented.
Were you surprised that no one was selling it? I mean, it sounds like something, with so many people having played this game, it sounds like something someone would have done before.
You would think, right? Very few times that when you go to Google and it results zero. So we knew we had something.
Wow. Now, the thing about the, first of all, for those who don't know the game, describe it. I mean, admittedly, I've seen the game played. I've never played it, but then I'm not a beer drinker. So there you go. So describe the game for those who don't know it.
Not a problem. If you play with beer, if you don't play with beer, people of all ages play with all different kind of favorite beverages. And usually typical gameplay is 10 cups set up in a triangle, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And teams on opposite sides try to shoot pong balls into the cups. If you get the pong ball in the cup, simply the game is removed from play. How you remove the contents of the cup is up to you. First team to remove all the cups from the table, that team wins.
Okay. Now, as with so many games that are out there, there are so many different variations. You can go from one region of the country or the planet, for that matter, and find a similar game played in a different way. So when you created your Port-O-Pong, did you print up Port-O-Pong rules?
We did. We took the basics of your house party beer pong game and applied a few additional rules to make it more suitable for playing in the pool or for tailgates where people aren't usually traditionally playing.
So when you created your game, and we should mention, as I said in the introduction, it's an inflatable beer pong table. So to describe it, it kind of looks like one of those rafts that you'd float along in a pool in, correct?
Yeah, I would compare it a little bit more to an airbed in terms of the quality and the thickness of it. It's not your typical disposable pool float that you get in the summer and have to toss away. Real high quality recessed cup holders, 6 feet by 4 feet by 3 inches for really good, strong playing action where if you're playing in the pool with it or if you're taking it outside and playing with it on a smaller table or tailgate on the hood of a car, you're not gonna damage the table, but it's still gonna provide you that portability that you need.
Now, when you and your buddies came up with this game, did you sit down and decide the dimensions? Because, again, sometimes, depending on where you see this game being played by people, it can be a slightly larger playing field, smaller playing field. So how did you go about deciding the exact dimensions?
Sure, no problem. So normally people are playing on 8-foot tables, and we just thought that the 8-foot table didn't lend itself for a portable, travel size, if you will, even once you fold it up. We looked at cars, hood of cars. We looked at typical apartments and dorms, what size tables people could get. And we found that 6 feet was a good size to allow people to have just the right amount of space to set it up. And if they wanted to shoot further away, we usually tell people just take an arm's length backwards from the table, and you get the same results of shooting at that 8-foot length.
Okay. Now, when you decided to put this game together, I mean, where did you know where to go? How did you go about creating it? Do any of you guys have either a marketing or manufacturing background?
I have a marketing background. I'm actually the team's marketing and web designer.
Ah, okay. So the actual substance that the table is made out of is what?
It's made out of a 12-gauge vinyl.
And when you went to the company, whatever company you went to produce this, did they kind of look at you going, what?
I had some people tell me I had my cups all wrong. They're not supposed to be in a triangle. They're supposed to be spread out across the table.
Really?
Well, that's how they usually make pool floats. They have the cup holders
across
the edges. And they thought it was a floating bar. I was like, no, this is for something we're developing.
Ah, gotcha. So how much does this game actually, this inflatable beer pong table go for?
Sure, we retail it for $49.99.
And people can get it online by going to the website, which is portopong.com?
Correct.
Now, I also heard that you might get a new spokesperson for the company?
I'm not allowed to get into too much details about that.
Okay. Can I say the name?
You can say who you think it is.
I've been hearing stories about Justin Bieber's dad.
Again, no direct comment.
no direct comment. Would it be fair to say that perhaps whether you get Justin Bieber's dad or not, that perhaps you had gone after Justin Bieber himself? initially?
We would be excited to have any one of the family members if they wanted to contact us about doing something.
Okay. I could understand, by the way, if you had gone after Justin Bieber and he declined, why he might think this would be a good idea for him to do. Because of his young age, and I want to bring up that aspect of it, even though you say it can be played without beer, it can be played with any beverage you want to play with, people are associating it with alcohol. Have you received any negative comments from people about coming up with a game like this?
Absolutely not, actually. We've, in the past, actually used the popularity of the product to help benefits, such as the Keep Abreast Foundation, where we donated a few thousand dollars from the sales of our pink tables. The aspect of playing with beer and not playing with beer really comes into question when it comes to the individuals. Again, we promote it as porta pong. We don't overly promote it as beer pong. We promote it as a fun game. We do have disclaimers all over. We do explain to people to check with their local and state laws. And we really just emphasize on the fun, portable aspect of the game board.
How long has this game been available? How long have you been selling porta pong?
We've been selling our porta pong tables for about 4 years now.
And how is it doing as far as what you initially had hoped it would do? Are you selling about the amount you thought you'd sell? Are you doing better? Are you surprised by its success? What?
I'm very happy with the way that we're working right now. The product is doing very well. Our first year out, unknown. Of course, you don't know what to expect, but we've definitely had growth every year, even in the year where the rest of businesses started to fail through a couple of years ago. So we're pretty proud that we're still around.
And where are the hot locations that your game is selling? Do you find there are certain regions of the country or even the world that are more prone to buying this than other parts?
Well, I don't think you're going to get anybody in Kansas as much as you're going to get the people near the lakes and the rivers. But we do find the hotbeds are usually our major cities, and we do find people from all over the world, as far as France, as far as Germany, India. Everyone has seemed to have contacted us to wanting to do something or to buy one.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, it's a game people certainly know well, especially if they went to college. I would assume this is a game, your game, porta pong, would be a big hit in the college crowd.
It is very popular amongst the college crowd, but we do find that the people who have graduated from college actually seem to be the ones who are more enjoying the product, as they're the ones that usually can afford to go on vacation or own a boat.
It certainly is a great idea to come up, but then again, I'm surprised that it was not something that had been done a long time ago, because it's a game so many people have played. Again, how much does a game cost? How can people get their hands on it? Tell us about the website.
Sure. It's $49.99. You can go to porterpong.com, or you can find us on Facebook as well.
Excellent. I thank you very much, Jerry, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks for having me on the show as well.
Jerry Piscitelli, one of the creators of Porta Pong. You can check out their website, and of course, you can find links to the site by going to thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0101. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In the very first segment of Let's Be Fair, I told you about our wacky warning label contest. Since then, I've revealed the funniest warnings ever submitted to the contest. But there is one funny label I've never told you about, because we've never used it in our contest. Since this is the 101st edition of Let's Be Fair, though, I'm going to share it with you, and tell you why we don't use it. The label is on a pain reliever called PMS Mitol. Obviously, it's for women, but it warns, do not use if you have an enlarged prostate. What? Let's be fair. You don't need to be a doctor to know that someone with PMS is not going to have a prostate. Kids, trust us. But the side effects of this medicine are not common knowledge, and there may be a man somewhere with a headache so bad that he's willing to use PMS Mitol, so that label needs to be there. Now, if you have a funny common sense warning that would be good for our contest, send it to us. Find out how at centerforamerica.org.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed,
This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll remember Sherwood Schwartz, the creator of Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for you. You know, more chain restaurant casualties of the economic crisis are in the offing, and three Marie Callender restaurants across Washington state shut down abruptly, leaving more than 100 people without jobs. But apparently, when Marie Callender decides to shut down, they decide to shut down right now. They bring new meaning to the term, abruptly. Witnesses say some customers were in the middle of their Sunday afternoon meals when they were told they had to get up and leave the restaurant. Mike Chim, who up until Sunday served as a manager at one of the restaurants, said, "I thought it was a big joke because I was like, I still have people in the restaurant, and they said, well, they have to leave." Mike added, "There was a party of 25 in the back room. It was somebody's birthday party, and I feel so bad, and we, like, ruined the whole celebration." Corporate spokeswoman Vivian Brooks confirmed the restaurant's closings, but wouldn't say why the decision was made so abruptly. Well, there goes the tip. Anyway, if I told you that two guys went at it, one with a chainsaw and the other with a baseball bat, who would you bet won? What if I told you it was an aluminum baseball bat? Well, it happened in Springfield, Virginia, and the baseball bat won! A 44-year-old Stafford man reported that 31-year-old Douglas Edward Turner was yelling and banging at his door. The resident said Turner cursed him and told him to come outside. Turner was reportedly upset with the resident about a woman, and the resident said that when he took a step out the door, Turner came from behind a bush with a chainsaw. He started it and then cut into the railing leading to the front porch, but did not injure the resident. Now, the resident was able to get back inside his home and close the door, but then Turner broke into the home with the chainsaw still running. That's when the resident grabbed an aluminum baseball bat and smacked Turner in the head. He fell backward out of the house and onto the porch, but then got up and tried to enter the home again. So the resident jabbed him in the midsection with the bat, knocking him off the porch. Turner staggered around the yard for a few minutes before getting into his Chevrolet pickup truck and driving off. Police searched the area and found the truck and the chainsaw down the street. They later found Turner in a hospital where they arrested him on domestic assault charges. He was also charged with assaulting two police officers while trying to flee the hospital. Gee, you know, if only Leatherface's victims had aluminum bats in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, might have been a more fair fight. Sean Collins, age 28, approached a teller in a credit union in Glasgow, Scotland, and demanded money. His weapon? An empty tuna can. The teller responded, "Are you having a laugh?" Collins pointed at some wire on the can and told her that it was a bomb, so she handed over £1,400. That's about $2,300 U.S. When caught, Collins explained that he was desperate for cash, he had lost his job after being convicted of assault, and needed money to comply with court orders to pay his victim £2,000 in compensation. And thus, the cycle begins of the long downward slide. Anyway, the fine folks at Kohler have created the ultimate toilet for those desiring the ultimate bathroom experience. First, there's a lid that opens automatically as you approach. Then, there's the pulsating and oscillating bidet with the integrated air dryer. Add to that an adjustable height, heated seat, and charcoal-filtered deodorizer. Warm air from a floor-level vent keeps your feet toasty. If you plan on staying a while, plug in your iPod or listen to the built-in FM radio. When it's time to flush, depending how long you've been sitting there, it will select either the 0.6-gallon or the 1.28-gallon flow. Kohler said it's a figment of beauty and geometry that offers the ultimate flushing experience, and they call it the NUMI. That's N-U-M-I. It's been 4 years in the making, and now it can be yours for the low, low price of just $6,390. And yes, installation is extra. Product manager Mike Marbach said, "It is our most advanced toilet, a blend of leading-edge technology and leading-edge design, and no sacrificing one for the other." Hey, it's a toilet. Anyway, Sometimes nothing can stand between a thirsty guy and a cold brew. An Alaska man is facing multiple charges for allegedly smashing a stolen vehicle into a Juneau brewery before fleeing the scene with several kegs of beer. Michael Ray, age 54, made his impromptu beverage run sometime early Friday. A morning shift worker at the Alaskan Brewing Company noticed the damage at the front of the brewery's retail store and alerted authorities. Police received a call regarding the crash at 4:59 a.m., according to Juneau Police Department Sergeant David Campbell, who said that roughly $400 in beer was stolen. The front doors were smashed in, one door was just completely gone, and the other door was pushed in, Campbell said. Brewery spokesperson Ashley Johnson called the incident, which caused an estimated $15,000 in damage, a literal smash and grab. It was a couple of kegs and a few 12-packs, so a comparatively small amount of beer, Johnson said. By Friday afternoon, Juneau police had recovered the stolen brews and arrested Ray at the nearby Switzer Village Trailer Park. Ray is charged with second-degree burglary, third-degree theft, and vehicle theft. Again, he's somebody who could have been an idiot of the day, but he's not. We'll get to that in just a matter of moments. But before we get to the idiot of the day to end this week's edition of the Stuff File program, I just want to take a little time to talk about a man who created several classic television shows. Perhaps you recognize this theme song.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of a fearless crew, the middle would be lost. The middle would be lost. The ship set ground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too, a millionaire and his wife, a movie star, the professor and Marianne, here on Gilligan's Isle.
That, of course, is the theme song to Gilligan's Island. The man who created that show was Sherwood Schwartz, and he passed away on July 12th at the age of 94. Now, I had the honor and pleasure of co-producing and hosting two shows at Montreal's Just for Laughs back in 1994 that honored Sherwood Schwartz. He not only created Gilligan's Island, but he was also the man behind the Brady Bunch. So we did two shows, one night with Gilligan himself, Bob Denver, and the second night with Barry Williams, better known as Greg Brady. Together, I got to ask the then 77-year-old Sherwood and his stars to reminisce about the iconic shows. Now, over the years, I've had the chance to chat with and work with many celebrities, but I can honestly say that I have never come across someone who had such joy and pleasure in what he did and what he created. Working with him is one of the highlights of my life, and I remember being backstage and asking him a question a few moments before we went out in front of the audience. He then proceeded to regale me with story after story of shows and stars that he had worked with in his long career, from Bob Hope to Red Skelton. The list went on and on and on. I actually had to interrupt him and say, "Sherwood, stop telling stories so we can go on stage and tell stories." He was beaming like a kid when he shared his past, and clearly, he led a blessed life. Now, he was also very busy, even right up until the end. At the time of his passing, his son Lloyd, who was also a producing partner with him, said he had a lot of favorite projects and a lot of favorite shows, and his favorite was always the next one. He didn't really die, he just ran out of time to do things. About 6 months before I did the shows with Sherwood in 1994, I had the chance to talk about Sherwood with Bob Denver on my old radio show. It was an easy way for me to do show prep about the show we were going to do on stage, because I was going to have Bob and Sherwood on the live stage anyway. Bob talked about meeting Sherwood and getting the role of Gilligan.
I had a meeting with Sherwood Schwartz, the producer, writer, and creator. And when he and I got done talking, I was on the floor laughing when he told me the premises of some of the, you know, and the guest stars and things. I said, "Are you sure the network's going to let you do this?" And he said, "Yeah, I've got permission to shoot the pilot." And so I said, "Well, you know, fine. You know, it'd be great. You know." So we shook hands, and that was the deal. And then we shot the pilot on the island of Kauai in the Hawaiian string there, and I still couldn't believe it when I was in Hawaii for 2 weeks shooting a half-hour situation comedy that was so stupid and silly. And then I figured, well, if it didn't sell, at least I got a nice, you know, 2 weeks, and I stayed an extra 2 weeks after, so I had a month on the island. And so I figured that was really nice. You know, if it didn't sell, fine. Then, of course, it sold and became a hit.
And Bob Denver, who himself sadly passed away in 2005, really appreciated working with Sherwood. They did so several times after Gilligan's Island.
As a producer, he was one of the best, you know, writer-producer. It's amazing. That man was just amazing. We never knew there was any problems when we were shooting. He kept all the network craziness away from us. He was writing scripts literally, you know, 4 months in advance. So, you know, special effects and props, always got them in plenty of time. And it was like working on a, you know, you just memorized your words and just went down there and had a great time. It wasn't until afterwards when I left, you know, I realized that not everybody was, you know, in the same situation.
Now I'm looking.
So every time I got a chance to work with him, I did.
And even though Sherwood was the boss and he wrote the scripts, he gave his actors some leeway in putting some of the funny into the shows.
Sherwood trusted us. He told us, I guess, in the first year, he said, just don't go too far. And we all broke up laughing, like, what do you mean, don't go too far, Sherwood? You're writing this stuff. And then, but he trusted us, like, if we could make up things and change lines and, you know, it was really funny, then we could do it. He got a kick out of it because, he'd watch the dailies of the day, you know, the shooting the day before.
Right.
And he'd come down and say, where did that come from? That was really funny, you know.
Sherwood is survived by his widow Mildred and their 4 children. And let me share a brief moment about Sherwood and Mildred. Again, when I met them back in 1994, they had been married at that point for over 50 years. Mildred was sitting in the front row of the theater for the 2 shows. The house had 400 seats. But when he talked about his wife, he looked at her, and she looked up at him, and it was as if there was nobody else in the room. Sherwood Schwartz is a man who will be missed, and boy, did he live a long, productive, and charmed life. It was a pleasure just to be near him. I just had to share some of this story with you.
So this is the tale of our castaways. They're here for a long, long time. They'll have to make the best of things. It's an uphill climb. First mate and his skipper too will do their very best to make the others comfortable in their tropic island nest.
No phone,
no lights,
no motor car, not a single luxury. Like Robinson Crusoe, it's primitive as can be. So join us here each week, my friends, you're sure to get a smile from 7 stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Isle.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. One more item to go before we end up this show, and of course that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
This one involves a little history. It was a 2004 gang-related murder that had frustrated Los Angeles police for 4 years until a homicide investigator paging through gangbangers' photographs for another case spotted an elaborate tattoo on the chest of Anthony Garcia. Evidently, that 2004 killing was such a milestone in Garcia's life that he had commemorated the liquor store crime scene on his chest. The investigation was reopened, eventually leading to a surreptitious confession by Garcia, and in April of this year, to his conviction for first-degree murder. Photos from Garcia's several bookings between 2004 and 2008 show his mural actually evolving as he added details, until the crime scene was complete enough that the investigator recognized it. Now why would you want to use your body as a human mural for the crime you committed and got away with almost a decade ago? One reason and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0101. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, it's 0101. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air online. online or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week's edition of The Stuff File. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing the show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.